and who we are, why we're here. This is Mame Warren. Today is the 31st of July, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Ted Delaney, who probably has worn as many hats at Washington and Lee as pretty much anybody. Did you grow up in Lexington?
Yes.
So asking you what your earliest memory of Washington and Lee is probably goes back pretty far.
Yeah, it goes back to when I was a small boy. I can remember Sunday afternoons when we were children. One of the real high times was going to Lee Chapel to look at Traveler's Skeleton, which was on display in the basement of the chapel. But yeah, it's a long time ago.
And was it really carved up and had initials in it?
No, not that I recall. In fact, the skeleton was in a glass case. Huh? And I'm sure there are confusions because there used to be a fully assembled camel skeleton in the biology department that did have initials on it. And in spite of the hump, there used to be people who thought it was Traveler, but it wasn't. In fact, the biology department used to have quite a collection of mammalian skeletons that were fully articulated, or that is, assembled. And now and then there were people who didn't realize that horses couldn't possibly be shaped like that. You would think this camel was a horse, but anyway.
What do you mean they used to have? What happened to all that?
I don't know what happened to the camel. I know that it was still there when I worked in the biology department, but things like that became a storage problem. The Traveler, of course, was after the chapel was renovated. I guess it was President Huntley at the time. Perhaps it was President Cole. I can't recall, but whichever. Didn't think that the renovated chapel was the appropriate place for a horse skeleton, and I agree. And for a while, Traveler was stored under one of the dormitories. And the Richmond Times-Dispatch got hold of that, and there was some controversy about Traveler being in a place of dishonor. The university asked the biology department to take Traveler, and the head of the department at the time, an older man named Kenneth Porter Stevens, decided that he didn't want Traveler in the biology department because every little old lady from the Confederacy would be traipsing around the biology department complaining that Traveler didn't have a place of honor there. And so the university ultimately buried Traveler on the campus. And I think the grave is somewhere near the chapel, although I'm not sure. But in any case, that's what happened to that skeleton. But the other large skeletons that were on the campus, that is one, I guess one time they were on display somewhere that the public used to see, I don't recall. But I don't know what the biology department did to dispose of them, but certainly they were occupying space that the department needed for other things.
I've seen pictures of them, and I was curious about what happened to all of them.
Yeah.
It's going to remain a mystery, huh? So, all right, you're this little boy going to see Traveler. What else do you remember about? Was it a playground? Was the campus a playground for you?
No, the campus was not a playground. And in fact, I don't know, I think the campus was, well, I'm not sure what I think of the campus from that part of my life. My family was pretty restrictive on us as far as our whereabouts were concerned when we were children, and maybe on Sunday afternoon we might do something like that. But generally we would not have been permitted to be across town on the W&L campus. But I grew up not far from the campus. In fact, I was born, and most of my childhood was spent just around the corner from where the visitor center is now. In fact, our family house, which looks pretty bad at this point, which is rented, I guess, to students, was a place, the address is 7 Tucker Street, and it's just around, well, it's right behind presently where Dr. Crew's office is. And so the other memory of Washington and Lee are the fraternities that were there, that were close by a house, the Pi Phi house, the SAE house. And of course, growing up close to fraternities was a little fun because where our parents might have been unhappy with the music keeping them awake, I can remember as teenagers, we weren't unhappy at all. I mean, it was great fun to lay in bed at night and listen to rock bands. And but nonetheless, you know, there was also the reality that Washington and Lee was a segregated campus, and even though it was close by, and even though the fraternities were our neighbors, I mean, it was, you know, there was that invisible line there that that was not crossed in the 50s when I was growing up, or even in the early 60s. I finished high school in 1961, and, you know, the idea of getting a degree from Washington and Lee in 1961 was an impossibility for a black kid in Lexington. So there also was the reality that as close as the vestiges of Washington and Lee were, Washington and Lee was many, many, many miles away in a different sense.
So did your family have any economic ties with Washington and Lee?
Not exactly. At one point in my mother's life, in a very, very short period in my mother's life, she had been a maid at a fraternity house. And I'm not so sure that she did that more than a year. And I'm not really so sure why. My mother's family was sort of unusual. My mother was one of six girls, and even though my grandmother was college educated, she didn't work, and my grandfather was a barber, and he taught all of his daughters how to be barbers, and so my mother, most of her life, worked as a barber, and cutting men's hair, and my father worked in Natural Bridge, and later in Roanoke, but there were no direct economic links to Washington and Lee except for that brief period that my mother worked in a fraternity.
Now, did you know, were you aware of what was going on in that period when Washington and Lee was first trying to get black students to attend?
Well, I started working here in 1963. And the first black student doesn't arrive until 1967. So I worked here for 4 years on a segregated college campus.
All right, let's start there then. Let's talk about that.
Okay. I came to work here in August 1963. And there were a lot of things that had happened in my own life that were sort of had pushed me into working here. One is that my parents had not been able to afford to send me to college, and I had never been able to, even though I had been out of high school a year, I'd not been able to obtain work. I finished high school when I was 17 in 1961. I had a United Negro Scholarship Fund to United Negro Fund scholarship to Morehouse College, and my mother didn't want me to go there because of the sit-in strikes. And the fear that she would worry about me for 4 years sitting at lunch counters. Nonetheless, my family didn't have money to send me to college. And at 17 years old, in Lexington, a black kid 17 years old, finding a job is virtually impossible. And it was probably one of the worst years of my life, 1961-62, not having anything to do. And at the end of that year, my parents permitted me to do something that I had not been, they had vetoed before, and that was, at one point I had been interested in the priesthood, and I was permitted at that point to try this since there was this frustration about me not doing anything. And so in 1962, in the summer of 1962, I went to Garrison, New York, and entered the monastery, the Graymore Friars. And I was there, I guess, about 7 months, and long enough to discover that that was not what God was calling me to do. And I came home, and then once again, there was the same situation, no job. And at some point during the year 1963, I got a waiting job, and I was waiting tables and not making a great deal of money. And then I sort of reluctantly did what seemed to be had been the history of black people in Lexington, ended up going to Buildings and Grounds here at Washington Lee looking for a job. And so at 19 years old, I came here to work in August 1963. I came here to work as a janitor in the biology department. And to some extent, it was sort of a lucky situation to be in because the biology department was having growing pains, and Dr. Stevens was in his last year as the department head, and they brought in this new man from North Carolina, a man whose name was Henry S. Roberts, more popularly called Pat Roberts. And he wanted to hire a laboratory technician for the department. And certainly, I'm sure his preference would have been one who had a degree. But there was not that kind of money budgeted for something like that. And so he decided that the next best thing was a bright high school graduate. And so I was in the right place at the right time. And the idea was the department would teach me everything they needed me to know. And so I went from pushing a broom to doing something very different. And I can remember at the time the salary raise was very impressive to me, but certainly in retrospect it's not impressive at all in a year's time because my job description changed. I got a $1,000 raise. But I think when I started working here, I started for something like $3,600 a year or something. And there was a completely different dimension to my job after that. And I was there in the biology department until 1983, at which time I quit my job and became a full-time student. But I had, beginning in 1979, taken courses part-time. There's a little known benefit that the university has where a full-time employee can take a course a semester free. As long as you can arrange it with your job supervisor for credit. And I had racked up, I guess, about 38 credits. And Bill Watts said to me one day, and he was the dean, you know, if you ever get serious about a degree, you have to be full-time 2 years. And so in 1983, I quit my job and became full-time student. But in essence, I was in the biology department from 1963. 1983. That's 20 years of my life there.
Did you develop an interest in biology?
Yes and no. I certainly enjoyed what I was doing in the biology department. Most of the stuff that I was doing, well, I shouldn't say most of the stuff. It probably was the craziest job description in the world, and if you talk to John Huffnagel, he could probably verify this because one of the things that I found in the biology department was that I had to work for about six different bosses. And even though I have the greatest affection for those people, one of the things that certainly is a part of being in a situation like that is everybody's needs are the most important needs in the world. And so oftentimes it was a matter of juggling things with regard to who you were helping in any given moment. Now, that's not to say there weren't a lot of times that were dull, a lot of times that were down, and certainly it was not a job in which I was doing frantic pace work, because I was not. But my responsibilities covered a multitude of things, many of which were interesting, some less interesting. One of the things that I did was I did laboratory preparations. With regard to the introductory labs, that was probably primary responsibility. General biology, for instance, I spent a great deal of time preparing solutions and either assembling equipment or setting equipment up for laboratories that were of a biochemical nature that taught them the principles of biology. With courses like general zoology, that ended up being probably a more interesting development than even doing the things with general biology. Certainly it intensified my interest, because I was working with a guy named Jim Starling, who was in the department for many years, who was a pre-medical advisor. And he was in his declining years, and declining years in as much as he had had heart surgery a few times. His health wasn't the greatest, and as a part of heart surgery, oftentimes his memory wasn't particularly great. And I would find very tiny parasitic organisms under the microscope to have on display for students to see with any given lab. And I would also help him set up the laboratory examinations. So I ended up being probably somebody that he came to depend upon more and more within. That probably is the one lab that I probably was most needed in, mostly because of his health and the level of dependency that grew. The younger people in the department didn't need me quite as much, and some of the stuff that they were doing was so sophisticated that they had to work hand in hand with me. And my mathematical abilities have always been very slight. And so when you come to mixing up some of these really sophisticated things, where you're going to have to do some real mathematics with the formula to make sure that you're doing it right, then they had to be with me. Other responsibilities included the greenhouse, the care of the animal room. I did the photographic stuff for the department, and that tended mostly to be making slides for to illustrate people's lectures. And I supervised 5 work study students, usually a year, for the department. We had a departmental library, which the secretary and I together essentially ran. I don't know, I'm sure I'm forgetting a lot, but there were a lot of things that I did, and developed some incredibly, incredibly good friendships with students during those years.
I wanted to ask you about that. What was your relationship with students, and did it change through the years as people's understanding of blacks at Washington and Lee changed?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about the relationships that I had with students over the years is really a part of understanding the South and what the South was like. And it seems to me that elite Southerners always had a polite relationship with people of color. The hostilities between the races were oftentimes hostilities that were between people of lower income brackets. And so you have a situation where Washington and Lee was essentially a rich white boys' college. Okay. And most of the students in those days were Southerners, and my relationship with the Southern students was very good from day one. In fact, one of the things that I never have forgotten, there was a Northern student one time who got to be very friendly with me in the lab, and I don't remember his name, but he proceeded to tell me one day, much to my surprise, and I was really annoyed by this, that should I see him on campus and he didn't speak, it was because he was with his white Southern friends, and that when in Rome you do as Romans do, et cetera, et cetera. And I pretty much didn't respond to that, but one of the things that was very interesting is that very quickly thereafter, he learned an incredibly important lesson and learned just how polite Southerners were. He saw me on the campus, and he was with two Southern students. And both of those Southern students greeted me immediately, and I greeted them. And I deliberately did not greet him. But I looked at him, and I think the point was gotten across that his assessment of the South was entirely incorrect, and it might have been correct if the students had belonged to a different social class, but one of the things that I think that C. Van Woodward and other scholars of the New South have certainly argued is that white and black Southerners have lived together and have known each other. And there has been a certain gentility with regard to the way they treated each other in spite of segregation. And my experience always was that the very worst of the relationships that were experienced with white Southerners were with those who were low income and not those who could afford to go to a college like Washington and Lee. Now that is not to say, that is certainly not to say, that students in the 60s were clamoring for this place to be segregated, desegregated, because certainly there is also the reality that Southerners, white Southerners of all social classes, wanted to preserve the status quo, and certainly the students here wanted to preserve the status quo just as much as any other segment of Southern society. So, I don't know, maybe I've rambled and veered away from what you were asking.
Oh, no, you're exactly where I want you to be.
Okay.
So, what did you see happen? How did the transition happen?
Well, there was a lot of stuff that happened here that I didn't like. The students that I was friendliest with, and the students who were friendliest with me, were the Jewish students. And certainly that is because there was their own little struggle in a society like this as well. I'll give you an example. During the 1960s still, and I'm not sure when this changed, but the charters of national fraternities read white Christians. And so those national fraternities not only were racially segregated, but they were religiously segregated. And there were two fraternity houses on the campus to which the Jewish students could belong. And those were the Zeta Beta Tau and the Phi Epsilon Pi houses, which were across from the entrance to the hospital. And those boys faced certainly some levels of anti-Semitism on the campus, and I can remember some of those guys that I was friends with used to be almost paranoid about the anti-Semitism that existed on the campus. Very, very strong friendships developed with Jewish students. It was not unusual to hear students put down students who were Jewish in my presence, which also said a lot to me about where they were with regard to people outside of their own ethnic or racial groups. Washington Lee was very slow to change in that regard. In fact, I can recall that in the late 60s and early 70s, when these barriers disappeared with the fraternities, some of the Jewish students were very unhappy when very attractive Jewish freshmen pledged other houses. And it essentially killed the two Jewish houses on campus, which functioned as carpools to Temple and Lynchburg. They had Passover Seder every year at the ZBT house, etc. But the changes don't happen at Washington and Lee until the late 60s, when Washington and Lee is desegregated. I can remember the discussions about desegregation among the students. And in spite of their gentility that I mentioned earlier, I can remember hearing some of the same arguments being voiced against desegregation that BMI has used to keep women out. I heard some of those same arguments here again 10 years ago when W&L was getting ready to co-educate. One of the big questions that I used to hear all the time was, well, where will they go to the bathroom? Well, of course, you know, there was the reality of Southern society that restaurants were segregated. I mean, there was a Leggett's department store, for instance, downtown that had two sets of bathrooms. And on one set, there was the word colored. And so students who were living in a society where these signs still existed in many places in the 1960s had a great deal of difficulty understanding that even though these people, these students who would come to Washington and Lee in the late 60s were their same gender, they couldn't possibly go to the bathroom with them, or couldn't possibly use the same bathroom. And there, you know, all of those same sorts of hang-ups. I met a guy on Saturday. It was really interesting. There was a banquet on Saturday in the dining hall for the kids who were here in the Futures program. And the Futures program, I guess, is 90% black and serves as something of a recruiting tool for the college. Well, one of the fathers that I met on Saturday had come here in the 60s. There were some weekend sort of seminar kinds of things that happened with Hampton Institute, which is a historically black college on the other side of the state. And so they brought these students and faculty members up from Hampton in the 60s to talk about desegregation. And this guy told me, it's really funny to run into, because I remembered the program happening, but I never attended any of those meetings or anything. But this guy told me that one of the things that he can remember so vividly is a student making the argument that black students could not possibly be educated to the level of a Washington and Lee education. And so there are these arguments about silly things like bathroom, but also more fundamental and deep-seated things like intellectual abilities and the inability of a black student to aspire to the level of excellence that Washington and Lee demanded.
Where was that coming from? From faculty or from students?
From students. Mm-hmm. In fact, the one faculty member that he remembered that was involved in these talks, who certainly would never let something like that go unchallenged, was Lou Hodges. And Lou Hodges is one of the most decent people I've ever met in my life. And of course, Lou was on the scene and was very much a vocal part of the community during those years as Washington and Lee moved toward desegregation. The one thing that I guess was a part of me, however, is that by the late 60s, when Washington and Lee was moving in this direction, I had no aspirations at all at that point about a college education myself. I was just sort of locked into my job and enjoyed the contacts that I had with students, enjoyed my job, and was just sort of floating by. I think the student body is probably very, very slow to change, and I'm not so sure they've completely changed today. But you know, I also have a sense of chronological order, and we can talk about where students are today later on in the interview, but I'll let you ask another question.
Okay, you mentioned when the first black students arrived. Now, my understanding is that Washington and Lee had to really go out and find people because no one was applying here?
Well, they still do. I may be wrong with my date. It was either 66 or 67. I think it's 67. The first black student was a local kid named Dennis Haston. And it was a disastrous situation, and so this part of it, you know, you certainly have to be careful with regard to your writing. Dennis was like a kid in a fishbowl. He was right out of Lexington High School. He was the only black student on the campus, and certainly not a desirable situation to be in. Dennis lived at home with his family and was one of six brothers. Brothers who work on this campus, I think at least one brother who works on this campus as a janitor right now. But Dennis did not survive the year academically, and he ended up transferring to a historically black college where he was completely successful and went on with his life and is a fine guy and a very successful person today. The next two black students were once again local students, but their experiences were very different from Dennis, and I'm not sure why. Perhaps Dennis had made people more comfortable with the idea of black student being here. Dennis was a pretty low-key, very nice kid. The next two kids were kids named Linwood Smothers. And Linwood's mother worked in the snack bar for many, many years. Her name is Fami, and his aunt Marie still works over there. And the other kid was a kid named Walter Blake. And those two boys were very, very different from Dennis in many ways. Linwood's mother is a very quiet, determined kind of kid. And as I recall, he was a physics engineering major, and we had some sort of program at the time where, I guess it was a six-year program. You did 4 years here and 2 years at Columbia, and you got a master's degree in engineering. And he was entirely successful. He was a good student. He did well here. Walter Blake was a politics major. And Walter also did here, but did well here. But Walter had an experience that was very different from Linwood's, and that is that Walter pledged a fraternity, but there again, one of the Jewish houses. He was a member of the ZBT fraternity. And this past year, I had a student who did an honors thesis on the desegregation of Washington and Lee, which has some problems, the thesis does. But he did send out questionnaires to black alumni that he didn't follow up on, and one of the two who responded was Walter Blake. And so that honors thesis is in Special Collections. And so Walter Blake still has, I think, important ideas to share about his experiences during the period. But those two guys were successful. They went through Washington and Lee. There was no major problem the whole time they were here. They sort of continued what Dennis had started. They were nice kids who showed that the school wasn't going to crumble because they were here. And then they recruited another bunch who, I guess, the first class that had any significant number of black students in it, I think, was the class of 74. I'm not really sure, but it certainly was a class that Bill Hill was in, and I don't know whether you got a chance to meet him last week. But one of the things that was very, very interesting is that Holt Merchant had a student, a black student, who studied desegregation of Washington Lee a few years ago, an independent study. And he talked to these guys, and they had nothing but good recollections of their 4 years at WNL. And the thing that just blew Holt's mind, and it blew mine as well, is that we remembered when they were here and how unhappy they were. So I think the years have sort of tempered their recollection of what the experience was really like.
What do you remember?
Well, I remember students who, and to some extent this still happens, I remember students who came in who were eager, who were absolutely willing to do their best, who found that doors were closed to them socially, and that at least the academic door was open there, but the social doors that were closed made it very difficult to be a student here. One of the things that you have to think about is that, first of all, it's an all-male environment. And one of the things is that human nature being what human nature is, in an all-male environment, there was a need for a female element. And there were even fewer black female students at the neighboring colleges. But the black students did not have the access to the female colleges that the other students had. The other students had automobiles. The other students had the fraternities as a vehicle for bringing, for attracting women to the campus for social events. And so the black students didn't have that. They weren't in the fraternities. They couldn't get in the fraternities. So there was some frustration because the social outlets weren't there. One of the things that I was very slow to learn about the black experience at Washington and Lee, and I was slow to learn because I wasn't in the quagmire that these students were in, was what their day-to-day experiences oftentimes were like with white students. And I understand that a lot better today, but I understand it from completely different experiences and with some of the experiences that I've had with black students more recently. But one of the things that in spite of the gentility that was always there, in spite of the civility that I always experienced, there was also an element that these students experienced that was not civil. And I was very slow to come to understand that, and very slow to come to believe that that non-civil element was there. And so the experiences that I had with students were very different from the experiences that some of these guys were having with students. I suspect, however, one of the reasons that their recollections are more moderate today than the experiences I think actually were is because of the doors that a Washington Lee degree opens. And when I finally got mine, I was really surprised to discover how receptive potential employers were to you when you said what college you went to, and or how receptive potential graduate schools were when they found out where you'd gone to school. So I think that those guys, at least as I understand it today, had some really horrendous experiences that were mostly experiences between them and other students. And some of them got to the attention of the student body as a whole, others didn't. One of the things that I can remember from those years is there was a student who started dating a local black girl, and there was some white student who was dating a local black girl, and there was some controversy on the campus because of this, and certainly people were more expressive of their feelings about crossing this boundary that was a taboo in the South than anything. Even as late as the 1980s, when I was a student myself, I can remember Holt Merchant seeing, he had a seminar that, well, it wasn't a seminar, it was a directed independent study, and I guess there were about four or five guys in it, and the topic was civil rights. And they said that they really wanted the experience of talking to someone who had experienced segregation, who had gone to a black high school, etc., because they didn't understand what segregation was. And Holt came and asked me if I would mind coming to his class to speak to these guys, and I said, sure, I'll do it. And I went in and I sort of turned tables on him. And I said, you know, I don't believe you don't know what segregation is. And they sort of looked at me a little strange, and I said, how many black students are in your fraternities? And then they began to explain to me why there were no black students in the fraternities, and they blamed it on the alumni and their parents. And my response was, the alumni and your parents are not here. You are here. But our parents will give us hell if we do this. Well, your parents are back home, and you know full well what segregation is because you are perpetrating it. And at that particular point, there were two of them who were sitting there, and I knew what fraternity house that they had come from. And an interracial incident had happened in their fraternity house just a couple of weeks before I was talking to these guys. And some guy in their fraternity had showed up at a fraternity party with a black date, and the fraternity squared off against each other because of this. And I said, you know, yeah, I went to a segregated high school, and I grew up in a segregated system, but you guys know full well what segregation is too, because look at what goes on in your midst. And so the other thing that I can only say with regard to that is I look at the students that I see who've come in, fairly conservative black students who've been radicalized by the system. One of them is a young black kid who just finished, John Branham, who I'm not sure it really identified himself as black until he came here. His mother was white, his father was black. John is very fair, complected. John grew up in the Mormon church, a fairly conservative Western kid. And John's argument to me was that the college completely radicalized him, that he had never thought about race as an issue before he became a student here. And so his senior year, he was president of the Minority Student Association. He went to the Million Man March. He was the kid who by himself brought Cornel West to the campus. So I'm not really so sure that the campus has changed very much since the 1960s with regard to students.
You have to turn the tape up.